Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. Welcome to episode 172 of the Garden DC podcast. In this episode, we chat with Christopher Barrett Sheridan, the flower sommelier, about fragrance in the garden. The plant profile is on loofah, and we share what's going on in the garden, as well as some upcoming local gardening events in the What's New segment. We close out with a last word on fairy gardens by Christy Page of the Food Gardening Network. This week, we're joined by Christopher Barrett Sheridan. He is the flower sommelier and a garden educator. Welcome, Christopher.
Hey, thank you, Kathy, for having me.
Great to have you on. So Christopher and I have known each other for a few years through the Garden Communicators Association GardenCom, and maybe we'll get into a little bit of some of those experiences, and we're going to talk all about fragrance in plants and scent in the garden. But before we get into that, Christopher, we like to ask our guests on the Garden DC podcast, were they born with a green thumb and chlorophyll in their veins?
And my answer, sadly, is absolutely not. I'm really the first generation in my family to live in, like, their whole life in a suburban area. My parents are originally from Center City, Philadelphia, South Philadelphia. It's a very nice area, but there was really no green for probably the four generations leading up to me.
And so when did you discover plants?
Well, I it's a funny story. I was thinking back on this, and, my first experiences in the garden would have been at my parents' house when I was two or three, and we had actually a rock garden. It was kind of interesting. I looked up, and the house was built in 1925. So, it was a porch with a canvas awning. There were two or three large azaleas. I think they were pink and red, if I remember right, a little bit of a lawn, and then a rock garden leading down to a box hedge. And the adjacent neighbors had a rose bush. So I used to menace the rose bush with my Tonka truck. So I was more of a digger than a gardener in my early years.
And so when you were playing around that rose bush, did you encounter some scent from that? Do you have any childhood scent memories?
I don't remember specifically about the rose. The other interesting thing is that I've had allergies my whole life when it comes to dogs and cats and pollen and all of that. So, I really wasn't a fan of yard work until Zyrtec was invented. But as far as favorable fragrance, Lanacera, there was honeysuckle. My mother was the director of the local recreation center, and there was, I guess, honeysuckle that had escaped, near the ball field and in a couple other places. So that's one of my best memories, I guess, of late spring, early summer, when it comes to flowers and plants, would be the honeysuckle at the baseball field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of us have that childhood memory of honeysuckle near a playground or some play space as a child, and using that to play with or share or, play house or pretend that it was a meal or something that we're sharing with each other. Because although you don't eat the blossoms, you can kind of pretend.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, the best childhood is one spent with plants. Mm-hmm.
So what was your career trajectory? What did you graduate from college and go into?
Okay. So originally I studied English literature at Villanova, and then I stayed to do a master's degree in international relations and comparative government. And then I went to Tulane to study environmental law. So I always cared about the environment. With regard to a career, I clerked for a couple judges, trial and appellate, and then I worked for a group called the Committee of 70, which is a government integrity group going back to the Progressive Era, 1904 in Philadelphia. So I was in-house counsel, and I also did a lot of civic education, volunteer management. So it was really kind of an interesting place to be, and it was actually genuinely nonprofit and genuinely nonpartisan, mostly focused on voter protection. And also just government integrity at the municipal level. And I really love that. And then I developed an autoimmune disease, which is what kind of necessitated the career change.
And then when you were looking for that career change, what brought plants or gardening into that scope?
Well, with regard to, like I said, I'd studied environmental law, and I guess I didn't mention the second house I grew up in was right on Fairmount Park, and that was in the 80s, and that was very much, you know, we had a large lawn and a, you know, foundation shrubs, a couple of, Japanese maple. It was really a beautiful place, and I'd always gone to, I went to a private school, it was very green, and also the rec center is where I, so I spent all my time really in greenery as a kid, one way or the other. And the so when it was time to, you know, kind of chart a new direction in life, I wanted to be outside. I figured that would be healthy. I also wanted something kind of academic and intellectual, but, you know, hands-on as well. And I think with horticulture, you know, it seems like people, you know, gardeners are happy people. And also, I apologize if I'm running on a little bit here, but, you know, Philadelphia, we like to call it America's garden capital. So it really is one of these creative clusters for horticulture, just like, you know, hospitals and universities. So I think, you know, when you're doing a career change, you want to pick something you enjoy, but also where there's a lot of opportunity where you live.
Mm-hmm. I can definitely relate to that. So let's talk a little bit about where you're gardening today and what you're growing. And I know you have two addresses. So let's start with the Pennsylvania one.
So Pennsylvania, we do... it's a lot of, I have fruit trees, I have cherries and apples. And then also, we have daffodils that do well. I mean, our real issue is the deer. So that's, I try to plant things. I planted Nepeta. We have mint in pots. And I recently purchased some Weigella we're going to plant, as well as a white lilac. So, you know, it really, it's still sadly, mostly because of the deer situation, you know, lawn and foundation shrubs and some specimen trees. But that's something I'm going to work on changing. Most of my gardening is really at the shore because you don't have the same sort of deer pressures and it's a smaller area to maintain, which is helpful.
And so the shore one, that's New Jersey Townsend's Inlet. Can you describe that growing area?
Yeah, it's basically a large border. And I kind of go with a cottage garden style is what resonates with me. I think going back to how I got into horticulture originally, you know, Pete Udolph and Meadows, that was kind of one of the first things I really drew me to it. And then I just, as I learned more and more, I just really liked the idea of cottage plantings and so forth. I've always been a fan of impressionism when it comes to painting and art. So I think that's really where the inspiration comes from. But yeah, the plants at the shore, we grow at, you know, Canna and Dahlia, so a little bit of tropical, you know, Carnation, Dusty Miller, some sage, begonias, alliums, Minarda, and then, some gladiolus, lavender, vinca. So a lot of it's what's in season, what's commonly used there. And we need tough plants because for the bulk of the season, we do rentals. Like we use the house some of the year, but you know, there's an 8-week period where I might be there one day a week. So I try to pick plants that can take that situation.
Mm-hmm. And being on the coastal plain, so to speak, I imagine it's sandy soils.
Yeah, really remarkably sandy. But the upside of that is I have echinacea that's 5 or 6 years old because it doesn't have that winter rot, you know, so it can be very helpful in a lot of ways, the sandy soil, you know, as long as you have the ability to, you know, keep it watered in the heat of the summer. I think it's actually in some ways, some plants actually really thrive in that situation.
And no deer, I take it.
No deer. One rabbit who only eats the echinacea. So I guess the bunny knows that echinacea's hunt is healthy. But, you know, it's a smart bunny. But, yeah, the rabbit doesn't bother anything else we have there.
And I imagine that's both zone 6 or 7 at both gardens?
I think it's 7A and 7B. So, the shore would be slightly warmer. It hasn't quite gotten to frost there yet. Pennsylvania, we're expecting frost tonight. But the New Jersey, we might have another week or two. I'm thinking it might get down to 34, 35 tonight and then bounce back. So you do get a longer, you know, it could be a 2 or 3 week longer season if you get lucky.
And are you growing edibles aside from the fruit trees at the Pennsylvania one? Do you do tomatoes or summer edibles or anything like that?
Mostly just mint on the deck. My father's been growing tomatoes for most of my life, my adult life, when they moved to a new house in the 80s. And so, yeah, so he's known for tomatoes and cucumbers. And so, yes, so that's a lot of what we do. That's something I really want to do more of, especially now that I'm, you know, specializing in fragrant plants. I really want to grow all of the herbs and a lot of the fruits and vegetables. It's just a matter of, you know, putting a new garden in. And I think, you know, the other challenge is when you have a health condition. I had 1 year where I had a community garden plot at Morris, and my health would go every 2 or 3 weeks, and I'd get overrun with thistles. So, you know, sometimes, you know, when you have one of these conditions, it's hard to have the continuity of being a gardener. So that's, you know, so that's why I'm a little bit more on the academic side, even though I absolutely respect everybody that you know, does the full-time gardening and the full-time hands-on work. You know, I absolutely believe in it, but sometimes it can be hard to keep up with.
Mm-hmm. So you call yourself the flower sommelier. And were you a wine sommelier at one point?
Sort of. This is after my health condition developed. I worked. A friend of mine owned a wine boutique in Delaware, a very nice place. It's no longer there. And so, yes, yeah, so I started helping out. And then eventually I was basically the weekend manager. So I would write the tasting notes. So I've probably written 400 or 500 wine notes. I've probably tasted 800 or 900 wines. And that's kind of having a literary background and then just an appreciation for wine. And that's what kind of, you know, gave me the inspiration for the brand, because it's, in a way, it's serious, but it's also kind of mocking myself. You know, it's meant to be funny. You know, it's meant to give people a smile. That's kind of how I intend it. And in the same sense, I think we should bring the same sense of enjoyment and adventure we have with wine or beer or whiskey, depending on what you enjoy, you know, to flowers. So I think we should, like I said, bring the same enthusiasm. And that's what I'm hoping to promote.
Interesting. Yeah, I always wonder with those, some of those wine descriptions, they can get a little like in the weeds, so to speak, where you're talking about some of the adjectives and descriptions that they do get a little, I would say, floriferous.
Yes, bacon and burnt rubber. And yeah, the wine wheel is pretty wild. I mean, we'll probably talk some about, you know, for fragrance classifications today. But yeah, I think with the, you know, the wine wheel really does get a little bit nutty at times. I mean, basically you get grapes and sometimes peppery and fruity. I mean, you know, so it's kind of a, so, you know, hopefully one of the things I'd like to see us develop as garden writers and horticulturists is basically a fragrance wheel that's comparable to the color wheel. And it might not be a wheel. It might be a pentagon. It might be a square. It might be a triangle among the, you know, among the fragrances and scents that we consider desirable, you know, how they relate to each other. And I think there's been some great work done with perfume, but the situation there is you're dealing with, you know, it's an oil that's the product. It's a, you know, I'm thinking diffusion, but, you know, distilled, you know, you're looking, dealing with distilled products, which, you know, certainly have validity, but that's not the same as the complexity of a leaf or flower growing in the ground. The same way our vitamins aren't the same as the food we eat. So I think that's a helpful start for us, the work that the perfumers have done on this. But I do think people, you know, like I said, in the plant world, it's something that I think we could be working on, you know. So I think that's part of where I take the inspiration for that is from wine. And just, you know, one of the things when I did the presentation at GardenCom this summer is I really like to kind of have us all speaking the same language and speaking more of it when it comes to plants.
Yeah, so Christopher is referring to the annual meeting we had in Minneapolis for the Garden Communicators and a virtual conference we also have where his talk on flower scents is available. And so diving into that, talking about a color wheel and shared, you know, sense of what we're both looking at or we're both smelling, do we all have the same sense of scent? You know, that's one of the things that we always ask ourselves is, am I seeing the same blue that you're seeing, or am I smelling the same thing that you're smelling?
And I think the quick answer to that is no. I did a little bit of research, and, you know, the National Institutes of Health, they talk about there's odor detecting cells that we all have, and we have many, many of them. But we don't all have the same mix of cells. So I think that's why some people, have a more acute scent, like something that's really pungent. We probably all get, you know, depending on the intensity of the fragrance, you know, sometimes we're all going to get the same thing, but as things, as scents are more subtle, we get a different perspective on it. And I also think that, you know, and this is partially my philosophy and partially what I've seen in the literature, you know, scent is so closely tied to memory. We have positive, we have negative memories, and that could, you know, definitely impact our perception. You know, the plants from your grandmother's garden or your mother or father's garden, you know, that's going to be a positive item for most people. The native plants from what part of the country you're from probably have special meaning to you from your childhood. Whether we're part of a faith group or nationality, that, you know, the flowers that are used in the celebrations of that group probably have significance for those people. And then I do think the people who, cook, you know, herbs, spices, fruits and vegetables, you know, I think the more different cuisines you have, you enjoy, and the more ingredients, you know, plant ingredients used to cook with, probably the better your scent palette is as far as being able to talk about things. So I think it's good for all of us to try a lot of new things. And, you know, one thought that came to me today is that, you know, our perceptions, we might even be introduced by flower color. You know, there are hot colors, there are cool colors, you know, whether a flower is something that is common or whether it's from the Orient or whether it's from the Middle East or South America, you know, things that are exotic to you, you might perceive a more exotic scent than the plants that you grew up with, regardless of the merits of each. So I think that's another kind of, whether it's folklore or anthropological consideration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I agree with you that a lot of it is cultural too, because, you know, you may love the scent of marigold. I may hate the scent of marigold, but that might have been a childhood memory, or it just might be the pungency to my nose versus your nose.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's also, if you think about, you know, those of us who were around in the 70s and 80s, remember when there were like one or two tomatoes at the supermarket, you know, there might have been one carnation you didn't like as a child, but now there are 100, you know, thanks to slow flowers and people like that. So that's another thing to kind of consider, that some of the plants, if we don't love the ones we grew up with, that might not be the best example of the genus or species or you know, any of the subcategories. So that's something to kind of keep in mind too. Just the abundance of choices we have now, you know, I wouldn't assume, just like, you know, there, you might not like one IPA, but you might love a different IPA if you're a beer drinker.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's very true, especially of roses, because in the Rose Society, we talk about, of course, whether a rose is scented at all. But then you have the classic rose fragrant, that rose essential oil. But there are many roses that have a spicy scent or a lemon scent. And if you were to smell them with a blindfold, you would never say that that's a rose scent.
No, absolutely. And I think roses, there's just so much variability because they come from so many parts of the world. I mean, the breeding material. So I think, you know, and that's a whole category in and of itself. And I think roses are probably the greatest challenge in studying fragrance among flowers. It really is a complex category.
Hmm. So let's dial it back and talk about, why do plants have scent in any case? Like, why, what is the purpose of a flower or a plant part having any scent to it?
Well, I think that for the most part, it's about, you know, attracting pollinators. And when we think of it, most of the scents are pleasing to us are also pleasing, you know, to the bees and the butterflies and so on. And then, you know, a lot of the rich scents, a lot of the evening plants have a richer fragrance because it has to carry further to reach, you know, moths and bats are a lot of our evening pollinators. And then we have the situation where, you know, the stinky fragrances are pretty much there for flies as well as for beetles. So if you think about the, you know, the Titan arum and, you know, there's, I think we might get to this a little later, but, you know, the Stapelia gigantea is called the carrion flower. So there's, you know, something that, so there's all the different fragrances that it depends on the pollinator relationship. And some of the early classification systems, it was the essential oil and the pollinator relationships was how they tried to categorize everything. So that's something that they looked at. But when we look at the other parts of so that's with the flowers, it's almost always about pollinators, pollinator relationships. When we look at bark, it's generally going to be about deterring pests, whatever pests, like, you know, cinnamon is a bark, you know, there's certainly a lot of examples. So, And when you look at roots, we have ginger, turmeric, fennel. Fennel, actually, the fragrance runs, of course, through the whole plant, as well as probably others have some measure of fragrance. But the roots, so that's largely probably a deterrent for whatever underground pest you might be involved there. So that's another case of deterrence. When you look at foliage, it's also for herbivores. They want to, you know, there's a lot of things we enjoy that the deer and rabbits leave alone. So that's another aspect of it. I think one thing we don't really talk about enough is, you know, when we think about oranges and lemons and even apples and, you know, tomatoes, both the foliage and the tomato have a fragrance that's kind of very much tomato. And so a lot of it is to spread their seeds. Like, we know it's okay. We want to draw on our pollinators. We want to defend ourselves from pests. But, you know, it's not just the colors of the fruits. It's also the fragrance that I think draws, you know, seed spreaders, including humans, to help them do their work.
Yeah, I think it's Michael Pollan's book where he talks about the relationship of plants and humans, and that some of the plants have tricked humans into using them as pollen or seed spreaders.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're working for them. And you know, another interesting one is like sweetbriar foliage. It's not the rose of the sweet, I think it's eglantine, the sweetbriar that's fragrant. It's the foliage. And I think it usually needs like morning dew or some moisture to really perform. Another fun one is that Cercetophyllum japonicum, so katsura, in the fall, the leaves smell like burnt sugar, toffee, or cotton candy are some of the representations. I think walnuts also have a pretty distinctive fragrance in fall. Fall and, you know, the walnut itself. And then Francis Bacon in 1625 mentioned dying strawberry leaves are supposed to be very sweet. So it's kind of, that's another one. Bacon in On Gardens kind of set forth a whole lot of plants that we would recognize now. In his essay that's literally 400 years old. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, some things change, but we love the classics centuries or millennia later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that katsura leaf scent, you know, stepping on those leaves and you release that sugary scent. And that definitely makes you want to plant one in your yard and propagate it and share it.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the thyme and the chamomile are great path plants as well. And some of the mints for, you know, as far as things that you can lightly walk on and generate some fragrance.
Mm-hmm. And repel some of those pests.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about fragrance categorization. So we're trying to, you know, make it scientific that what I am detecting from a flower is the same thing that you're detecting from a flower, and use some of those same descriptive terms. So can you talk about some of those categorizations that already exist?
Sure. Well, I think I can just, we're going to talk about one of them, but just to kind of give a little bit of the history, Frank Anthony Hampden wrote the scent of flowers in 1925, and that was the first real modern classification system. And he had separate categories for flowers and foliage. And then in the late 1960s, Wilson and Bell, who were serious amateur gardeners, one was a writer, one was an illustrator, they developed their own system. And it's the modern classifications of fragrance. It's part of a book called The Fragrant Year, a real beautiful book. That's something everyone should have, from 1967. And so British American, and then we get back to Stephen Lacey in the 80s and 90s, came up with a set of classifications that you can find in the RHS Companion, which came out in 2014, the updated version. And so Lacey follows Hampden in keeping separate categories for foliage and flowers. And most recently, Ken Drews in The Sensual Garden, he has his own system. It's 12 categories. And what I really like about Ken's system is that he has primary and secondary scents. And I think it was Ellen Hovekamp was his a photographer and also his collaborator. And they went through and really set us up with, they formalized the idea that, you know, what are you, you know, Kathy, you and I might get something different from a flower. Well, Kathy might be getting the primary scent and I might be getting one of the secondary scents, just based on our perception and so forth. So I think that's, you know, kind of a very interesting advance from my point of view that, you know, we can talk in terms of, well, what's the primary? And then there might be one, two, three, four secondaries, depending on whether the flower is emerging or at its prime or senescing. And same thing with foliage, is that everything goes through a life cycle. So that really, so secondary qualities or secondary scents really are valuable to our discussion. So that's kind of the big picture of kind of how we got here. And so far, there hasn't really been one unified system. I mean, they all have a lot of merit, but it, you know, that's one of those things. I think it would be great that if we could get towards a color wheel, you know, something that's, you know, widely accepted and widely used would be great. I didn't mean to digress too much there. But so just as an example, I'll use Lacey for this one. Lacey has, under exotic, he has Jasmine officinale, tobacco flowers, and clerodendron tichotromum. You know, for vanilla and almond, he has Clematis armandii and montana, and then a bilophyllum and umlaria. And I do apologize for my my botanical Latin is not the best. I'm good at spelling it. I'm not necessarily good at speaking it.
I think all of us have stumbled over some of that botanical Latin, but, you know, I've been told that any pronunciation is correct.
Yeah, and I think one I like here with Lacey, just yeah, absolutely, because there are no Romans here to correct us. But like French perfumes, I think that's a great way of describing a category. So that's Lily of the Valley, Mahonia japonica, which I think is winter blooming, and then Skimmia. So like Lily of the Valley, people will say, "What's the fragrance, Lily of the Valley?" And there's nothing wrong with saying lavender smells like lavender. You know, some things just are so distinctive. Violet smells like violet. Although there are other flowers that smell like violet, just like there are some of the geraniums smell like roses. So this is basically how the systems are organized. And, you know, for Lacey does the flower scents, just to run through the overview of the categories. So it's exotic, spicy is the second one, vanilla and almond, pea scent, PEA, French perfumes. And then he has rose, fruit, honey, rogue scents, and then less pleasant scents, which he's being polite about. And generally speaking, going back to Hampton, roses are always their own category. You know, each of the people who've done this takes a slightly different approach on what belongs in heavy, what belongs, you know, in honeyed and so forth.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we just use simplistic terms like sweet or pungent. And I would think, you know, just trying to classify it as almost an edible type of term. So lemony or spicy or fruity, we're talking more about our taste actually than the scent or fragrance.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And that's one of the strengths. There's a lot of great things about Ken Druce's book, but one of them is that he has a pretty good set of adjectives when it comes to describing each of his categories, pretty comprehensive and closer to like the wine wheel example we were talking about earlier, where some of it's creative, some of it might be a little bit far out, but it gets us beyond floral and sweet and so forth. And then with Lacey, again, so he follows Hampton, has foliage categories. So, just the categories are spice, aniseed, rose for foliage as well as flower, fruit, camphorous and pungent, resinous, mint and eucalyptus, fresh and green, and then less pleasant, again, putting it politely. So this might be one of those, you know, how, Kathy, you do your different events, your horticultural events. This could be an interesting quiz opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk a little bit of an aside about some of those not so pleasant scents and how people experience them. So you mentioned earlier the Titan arum.
Was it Amorphophallus titanium?
So that one, actually, people want to experience the horrific scent of that and be in that room. Why would humans want to do that?
I think it's just people, I guess it's like extreme sports. It's extreme flowers, right? Some people are really drawn to that. It's interesting because usually it's like a reddish brown, the flower. And I think that's the inside of the spathe when it comes to the Titan arum is like a blood red. It really, in addition to the smell. So that's certainly the most famous of the stinky plants. Another one, and I think we all love the structure of it, like the architecture, the Fritillaria imperialis, Fritillaria So the crown imperial, I mean, it's usually you have those pendant flowers. They're usually what a solid orange or gold with like a little ruffle of a, it almost looks like a leaf ruffle around them. It's a beautiful plant, but you want to put that at the back of the border. But it's described as foxy and sweaty. So those are things we do not want in the front of the border or under our window. I mean, another example, and this is interesting because it's the pawpaw, Asimina triloba. The flowers are reddish brown. They're actually kind of pretty. It's a nice little shape. And I guess in some ways it's almost like a little trillium, because of the whole, but they said it's in, and I've actually smelled this one. It's like, it does smell like carrion and the it's flies that do the pollination. But then the fruit is supposed to be one of the greatest delicacies anywhere, and it's hard to find because it's I read a great book years ago called Pawpaw, and but you have to be in that region of like Western Pennsylvania, Ohio. I guess parts of Maryland and Virginia might have pawpaws, and you can certainly plant them. I guess you need two of them in order to set fruit, but because it's so perishable, you can't even necessarily find it at the farmer's market unless it's abundant in that area. So you have this awful flower, and then you have this wonderful fruit that comes from it. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Another famous one would be the ginkgo, the fruit, right? Is
Yes.
something that it can be, and they actually had these at my grade school, and I remember walking on them. It was awful. The ginkgo fruit, I guess in the fall. But I know some cultures that the seeds, people roast the seeds, and there's warnings to eat them in small quantities, but the seeds are a delicacy, I think, especially among Asian cultures. So that's another one that, you would think if you looked at it, you would never know that there was something really special inside.
Yeah, I think many of us especially in Washington, D.C., have had that experience of coming around a corner of a block and smelling something, akin to dog vomit, let's just call it that, and not knowing where it came from, and then realize you're stepping in it. And that's the fallen ginkgo fruit on the ground. But
Yeah.
yeah,
And you
and
have the ones, people can be a little ambiguous too. And like the Bradford pear, fishy or cat urine, the descriptions, boxwood, cat urine again, Crataegus, hawthorn, fishy or an ammonia scent. So some things, it's interesting. Some repel us all. But I think this goes back that if you grew up in England where you have hawthorn hedges, then maybe that's it reminds you of home. So it's not a bad thing. So that's another one is, we have our friends all over the world could have very different perspectives on the same plant based on their life experience.
Or cultural connotations to them, but I would say that very much so with some of the boxwood that does have that, I'll just call it sour scent to it. And Houghtonia is another one that comes to mind, chameleon plant, because I know people when they're trying to dig it up out of the ground, it has just like a horrible gasoline type scent. Some people describe it as very skunk-like, which is again not another pleasant scent.
Yeah, there's the skunk cabbage is another one with a reddish brown and green the spathe, rotten flesh. And then the when you look at the terminology, when we did the presentation this summer, it was I had all the botanical Latin that refers to what's it called it, to fragrance. And one of my favorite, hircine, if I'm pronouncing it right, and it's goat-like. I don't know. You want anything goat? Certainly not among your house plants. I mean, maybe at the back of the border, but that's it. But it's funny some of the terms that come up to describe these plants.
And I'm thinking in particular of plants that have it in their common name too, like stinking hellebore, hellebore's fetidus, so fetid, and it really doesn't smell that bad. That makes it sound like something you would never want in your garden.
Oh no, it's something you send to your worst enemy if you could.
But yeah, the ones when it has something like corpse flower as a name, I think you can pretty much bet that you're not going to enjoy that.
And that's the other thing I talked about in the summers. The common names can be, sweet grass, and you can think of all the different common names for these plants that really also help us understand that it's a fragrant plant. Some are negative, some are positive. But it's interesting the tie between the fragrant plants and the folklore, as well as the language of flowers, is very strong.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to a lot of poetry, especially, from Shakespeare on, using some of those. And some of those that some poets refer to, we don't get much of a scent anymore. So the poet might talk about primroses and unless I'm getting down all the way, you know, down to the ground, I'm not really smelling a primrose that much.
No, I think it's, yeah, a lot of it is, you know, the history of breeding. I mean, generally, larger flowers or longer bloom period. I think with genetics, you, when you, whatever you get, you're generally giving something up is kind of the common wisdom on that. So, so, you know, hopefully we'll see. And I think I've already begun to notice it in the last year or two. People are, you know, talking more about fragrant plants. I've seen more advertising. Hopefully we get back to breeding plants for their fragrance and not just their color and longevity and durability.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. A lot of the landscape roses, the fragrance was bred out, not on purpose, and but, you know, just because other traits were selected for, and that can certainly be bred back in just by introducing a more fragrant cross with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, yeah, I think that's the future. You know, we'll see that.
So how about some fragrant houseplants? So having them inside, I think in particular when I say houseplants about paper whites, enforcing them for the holiday season. And I'm not a huge fan of that kind of astringent smell, that strong smell, or forcing the Dutch hyacinths can be a little bit too fragrant, even though it's a pleasant fragrance, it's just a little too much in a confined space.
Yeah, I think that's true. Like the intensity of hyacinths. I'm not really a fan of paper whites. That's one that, you know, I kind of always felt was a little bit strong. I haven't smelled it myself, but you have Hoya, and then really there's so many different orchids. You know, if you're looking for a fragrant house plant, I think there's probably literally hundreds, if not thousands, of orchids that offer that. And that's a category I haven't had a chance to get deep into just because it's so massive. But I know, but there's actually a book by Stephen Frohwein on fragrant orchids that's very good. But yeah, I think, and, you know, I actually like in the house, we'd won, there was a pot of dianthus brought into the house that was going to be planted, but I just sat it on the dining room table at the beginning of the summer at the beach. And it really, it perfumed the whole house in a pleasant way with the spiciness and all of that. And I don't remember the cultivar, but that's something that, you know, and in some ways it's interesting too, that would probably be thought of as a more masculine scent. Some scents are probably considered more feminine. But I think they're all special. It's kind of like there's a season for everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's the things you truly love, but I think it's good to make room for things that are interesting as well. And maybe you grow to love them.
Yeah, and I like your example of the dianthus because, again, the florist carnations that have been bred for decades now are pretty much scent-free, and I would say generic. But when you're getting those garden-grown carnations, the dianthus, you have that beautiful spiciness to them. And that does bring in scent when you bring cut flowers inside to enjoy. So I'm thinking like an armful of lilacs brought in or mock orange. What are some of your favorite cut flowers to experience?
Yeah, I like lilac. I mean, mock orange, I definitely like anything citrusy, you know, magnolia grandiflora. So I think the citrusy magnolias, you know, cherry blossoms, wonderful, apple blossom too. And that's something that you can do, you know, if you have a tree, you can do bring some cuttings in. Winter sweet is one of my favorite. Like I said, it's Chimonanthus praecox. They have one at Morris Arboretum by the Welcome Center that's just really wonderful because in February, that's really what's popping. And it's more subtle. All the witch hazels, I think, are a good category that can also be, you know, used as cuttings as well. You know, just and you know, it's just there's so many to choose from. Sometimes I get a little bit overwhelmed thinking through the list. You know, daffodils. You know, it's a narcissus. Mm-hmm. You know, was it the triand? Usually, the smaller and the species daffodils, I think, tend to have the most fragrance. Mm-hmm. And species tulips, and that's something I haven't had a chance to research personally, but I know from the books that there's a, you know, can have a fair amount of fragrance. The original tulips, the natives.
Yeah, I think they have a very, I've forced them indoors and they just have a very light fragrance, not as much compared to, say, a daffodil or a hyacinth, but still good. And I was going to say for the witch hazel, I don't know anybody who doesn't love the scent of witch hazel flowers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's really, and I think it's a lot like the snowdrops and the Eranthus hymalis. Winter aconite, you know, it's like with the way we love the small bulbs in the winter, you know, it's because they're, that's what we've got. You know, it's like some of the winter bulbs aren't impressive compared to the spring and later bulbs. But I think the winter fragrant shrubs, it's, you know, it, and the air is clean and crisp. And I think that's a lot of what we embrace about those plants, is that it's, you know, kind of like a ray of sunshine when there's not a lot of alternatives.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also thinking of like the depths of summer when it's hot and humid out, and the lilies, anything in the Lilium family, it just, you know, kind of just hangs in the air really thickly. I love that scent.
Yeah. And it's a dramatic flower. I mean, the shape is, you know, kind of adds to the, you know, the fragrance fits the flower, you know, and it's funny. Sometimes it's almost like, you know, people and their dogs matching or something, you know, how people we sometimes say that, you know, it's like you can match the person with the dog, but you can also, I think, often match the fragrance with the actual inflorescence it's coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes you're standing in the middle of the garden and you don't know where that scent is coming from. And I find that, I think osmanthus is one of those that I would call sneakily scented.
Yeah. And it's, and I think that's the other thing is, you know, the something can, and in the literature, something may not smell wonderful if you put your nose in the flower, but if you're further away, it's really enjoyable. And it might be that the heavy molecules that don't travel far are unpleasant, and the lighter molecules of fragrance that might go 5, 10, 15 feet are quite pleasant. So that's another interesting dynamic that some of the flowers have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that some research that the close-up scent of some flowers aren't supposed to be experienced because they're trying to repel you at that, but then they're trying to attract the pollinator from the air to come visit it.
Right. Yeah. So they might want the pollinator, but they don't want the deer taking a bite.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably. Yeah. And I hadn't thought of that before, but that's probably a very good strategy.
Yeah. So then that always makes me think of like a toddler or a kindergartner having a totally different experience of your garden than you are.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I don't think we've gotten to the evening scents yet. Do you want to touch on that?
Sure. Let's talk on those.
Okay. Well, Nicotiana is one of my favorites. And I just pulled a few from a list I have. I think everyone will know, you know, evening primrose is beautiful. And the primrose, it, you know, you also get that moon garden effect from the flower. So that's a cool one. You know, Detour, the thorn apple, is it's kind of like a baby Brugmansia, I guess, is kind of the way of looking at it. And then the Mirabilis Jalapa, 4 o'clock's open in the evening. And daylilies, you know, I've read are more fragrant at night than during the day, which is kind of an interesting, the flower lasts the day, but it performs at night. And then there's Cestrum and Jasmine, Matthiola, also known as evening stocks. And that's another one where, you know, the common name gives you, well, actually it doesn't give you a hint. I'm thinking evening scent. But yeah, so I think there's maybe 40 or 50, you know, evening plants that are fragrant, which, you know, I mean, most of us have more time in our garden at night to enjoy it. So it's really makes sense to look those up and plant them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had a recent episode about moon gardening, and of course, the scent of the garden and some of those evening flowering plants are essential to the moon garden experience.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And I've already read that. Actually, I was asked to review that moon garden for a magazine. So I've read it. And I thought your interview was wonderful and the book is wonderful as well.
Hmm. Well, thank you. And I'm sure the author thanks you as well. So wrapping up about scents in the garden, what can we say to those people who don't have much of a sense of smell? What are some really strong, strong plants that they might still be able to experience or detect?
I think I'm just pulling up the, we have the, like I said, Wilson and Bell under the heavy category. We have the Lilium auratum. We have jasmine. We have a orange blossom. We have gardenias, jonquils, the jonquil, the narcissus, cestrum. I think honeyed would be another good category if you think about. Hawthorn, they have arbutus, mahonia is in the heavy category. And I think I'm just kind of thinking about it, but I think things that are more pungent and the other one is. I actually recently ordered one of those aromatherapy kits, and it has maybe 70 different flower essences. So I'm going to try and teach myself with the aromatherapy items, just to, you know, things that we just don't encounter. We know the names of, but you rarely see them in a public garden. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's, you know, whether it's people, you know, arranging flowers or, you know, growing them in their garden or just visiting public gardens. And at least the literature does say that we lose our sense of smell does decline for many of us as we get older. So I think just like your brain, just like your muscles, the best way to keep it is probably to actively use it. So I think that's for people that have a lesser sense of smell, maybe to try and train it to the extent they can. And then just really go with, you know, focus on things that are, you know, like I said, more pungent, more strong, or, I mean, hyacinth. I mean, you think about that, that's very powerful and it's pleasant. It's just a lot. And you know, one of my favorites, I don't know that we talked much about, it might be one of your favorites as well, violets. I just, you know, I love the happy faces and the fragrance is just like spring. That's kind of how I think of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do adore violets. And another scent I was thinking of that doesn't come from the flower necessarily is balsam or pine. And just having that essential oil available or having a candle that is infused with that essential oil is a great thing to have around the holidays to evoke those childhood memories.
Oh, absolutely. And that's another one for people who may be a little bit, their sense of smell might be a little bit compromised. You know, I mean, rubbing mint, rubbing rosemary, and then having the essence on your fingers might be a way, you know, of experiencing it more so than just dipping your nose into a bloom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I'm a big fan of essential oils just because of those reasons you stated, in that you can have those year round, not just when the blossom is in bloom in your garden or that you have access to it at a public garden, but also you can share it and you can experience it whenever you want to.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how can our listeners contact you, Christopher?
Okay. Well, my website is www.flowersommelier.com with just one S in the middle. And my Instagram is flower.sommelier.com. But if you go to my website, there's a contact link where you can email me directly. And that literally in a minute is in my email. And also my other links to social media, as well as LinkedIn, for anyone in the horticulture world. If you'd like to connect on LinkedIn, obviously it's great to hear from folks. So the website's really a good way of connecting with me on any of the social media that you might use and enjoy.
Great. And I know that you have some upcoming talks and classes scheduled. Do you want to share a little bit about those?
Sure. I'm going to be teaching three classes at Longwood next year. And the first one we're going to do on April 16th is going to be a Tussie Mussie workshop. So we're going to do a tour of spring fragrant flowers, and then we're going to do two arrangements in the atrium of the gift shop, because Longwood is still undergoing massive renovations. So I don't know that we'll have an education building for about a year. So we go where there's room. But I'm really looking forward to that. Then we're going to do a fragrant Ikebana class in the summer, and we're going to do a bulb lasagna in the fall. And I have a lot of other things in the works, but not quite final yet.
Excellent. And for those listeners outside the Mid-Atlantic USA region, Longwood that he's referring to, of course, is Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. All right, Christopher, thank you so much for sharing the theories and some interesting facts all about scents in the garden. Do you want to share maybe one final scent for our listeners to enjoy?
I think Philadelphia's mock orange is one that I really like. I think that's generally in June. I think it's just really pleasant. That's one that just kind of says summer to me. And again, going back to childhood, the honeysuckle. I think we all have really positive memories of that. So that's another one I would mention.
Excellent. Thank you, Christopher.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Kathy.
Luffa plant profile. Luffa, Luffa species, is a gourd that is dried and used to make a sponge. It is an annual vine that is part of the cucumber and squash family. It is hardy from USDA zones 7 to 13. There are two main kinds of luffa, the Luffa aegyptica, also known as the angled loofah, ridge loofah, Chinese okra, or vegetable gourd, and the loofah acutangular, or loofah cylindrica, also known as the smooth loofah, Egyptian loofah, dish rag gourd, or gourd loofah. Plant them from seed in late spring in a full sun location with good draining soil that has been amended with compost or aged manure. The vines can grow up to 30 feet, so a large trellis or fence is required to support them. The bright yellow flowers of the loofah vine are quite attractive. When pollinated, they grow into a long green gourd. Leave them on the vine until they start to turn yellow or brown, then peel them to reveal the fibrous sponge inside. Shake out the seeds and save a few to plant next year. Then wash off any sticky sap in a bucket of soapy water, dry them in the sun. The young fruits and flowers of the loofah vine are all edible as well. Loofah vine can be attacked by the cucumber beetle and can get touched by powdery mildew during hot, humid weather. Otherwise, it's relatively disease and pest-free. The vines will die after they are hit with a frost and can then be composted. Loofah, you can grow that. What's new in the garden this week? Well, like most of us in the mid-Atlantic region of the United States, I got hit by a frost or freeze a couple nights ago, and my garden took somewhat of a hit, but some things are still going pretty well. I think the coleus is the one that got it the worst, but my dahlias are still looking great, as are my impatiens and lantana. Some local gardening events that you might want to attend include the virtual meeting of the Potomac Rose Society on Sunday, November 19th at 2 p.m. It is a spring rose garden tour, and that will take you through several rose gardens up and down the East Coast, starting with the Jasper Crane Rose Garden at Brandywine Park in Wilmington, Delaware, and ending with the Risenhausen Park Rose Garden of the Garden Club at McKee's Arboretum, McKeesport, Pennsylvania. And you can sign up for that for free. It is open to the public. You just have to register to get the Zoom link at potomacrose.org. Another upcoming event that I'd love for you to participate in is the discussion group, Our Garden Book Club, and that is on Thursday, November 30th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. via Zoom, and you can register for that through our washingtongardener.blogspot.com website, and just look for the Garden Book Club. And we are discussing Orchid Muse, A History of Obsession in 15 Flowers by Erica Hanekel. And another event that I know you'll be looking forward to this holiday season is Longwood Gardens' celebration of a very retro Christmas. That starts on November 17th and runs through January 7th, 2024. Longwood Gardens is, of course, located in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, and it has time tickets, so you'll need to register and purchase those through longwoodgardens.org. Happy gardening!
Hey there, garden lovers. This is Ray Eaton, founder of Discover Garden Tours. I'm here to invite you all to join us next April and experience the beauty of Dutch gardening and horticulture on our Discover the Netherlands tour. Please join us and speaker, author, and social media influencer Kathy Gents for this once-in-a-lifetime garden adventure. We'll visit private and public gardens, flower shows and auctions, and much, much more. Highlights include the Kuchenhof Gardens, Hortus Botanicus Leiden, and the Flora Holland Flower Auction. The tour dates are from April 16th through April 25th, 2024. Full details and registration are available on our website at discoverourtours.com. Remember, space is limited, so if you don't want to miss out, I would highly recommend signing up today. We look forward to seeing you in the Netherlands and sharing this unforgettable journey together.
Get low-maintenance alternative to lawns with the new book Ground Cover Revolution by Kathy Jentz. Reducing the lawn is among the biggest trends in homeownership, with an endless stream of homeowners looking for an eco-friendly alternative to a traditional, everyday grass lawn. In the last few years alone, over 23 million American adults converted part of the lawn to a natural landscape, and now are looking to do even more. The biggest challenge to adopting this new ideal, the perfect lawn, is knowing how and when to replace your turf and which plants are the best ones for the job. Ground Cover Revolution is here with all the answers you need. Included are 40 in-depth profiles of plants that are perfect choices for replacing a grass lawn. There are options for sun, for shade, for dry and wet sites, and for various climates around the globe. There are choices that bloom, options that are evergreen, and selections that are deer-resistant. Author Kathy Jentz has also included an incredibly useful chart that gives you all the details on each of the 40 choices for quick reference and to make your ground cover selection process even easier. Whether you want to replace the entire lawn or just reduce the amount of land dedicated to turf, Ground Cover Revolution will help you usher in a new and improved idea of what a beautiful lawn should be. Available at bookstores now and also at Cordo.com, where you can get 30% off using discount code GARDENING30. In the new book, The Urban Garden, by Kathy Jentz and Terry Spade, you'll find dozens of inspiring and creative ways to grow flowers, shrubs, vegetables, herbs, and other plants in small spaces and with a limited budget. Whether you want to grow on a balcony, rooftop, front stoop, or a tiny urban patio, turn your growing dreams into reality and build a gorgeous and unique garden that showcases your personal style while still being functional and productive. With the ingenious ideas and resourceful tactics found here, you'll be maximizing yields and beauty from every square inch of your space while also making a lush outdoor living area you'll crave spending time in. Whether you're growing edible plants or beautiful flowers, the 101 amazing growing ideas found in the urban garden will turn your tiny urban yard into a treasure trove of green you'll be proud to share with family and friends. Buy your copy today at your local retail bookseller or order it online now at amazon.com or bookshop.org.
This is The Last Word on My Fairy Garden by Christy Page at Green Prints. I have always been fascinated by fairy gardens. As a child, I completely believed in fairies. I was convinced that they lived in nooks and crannies. They used buttercups to bathe in and spent afternoons napping under mushrooms. If there was a sparkle in a sunbeam, it was a fairy flitting by. And if there was a light tinkling sound, it was their laughter. I believed in a world of magic. As I grew up, I did not want to let go of that magic. I shared stories with my daughters of little woodland creatures. Fairy tales were a part of our nighttime rituals. As my daughters grew older, they may not have believed in magic and fairies, but they at least humored me. I visited several small fairy and gnome gardens and paths. They intrigued me. The time and dedication it took to plan out a fairy village or a gnome path was inspiring. There's even one a couple towns over from me where they welcome people to walk down the path and admire the decorations. This made me think that it might be time to start my own fairy garden. I mentioned it to my family, and although they may not have thought I was a little crazy, they were all on board. That Christmas, I received fairy and gnome items from pretty much every family member. I could not wait for spring. Once the snow had melted and spring was well upon us, I started planning out my fairy garden. I had houses, a little pond, benches, bridges, and even a little Ferris wheel. I spent an entire afternoon one weekend setting things up. I had the fairies all on one side with a town center and a park. Over the bridge, which was guarded by a dragon, is the gnome village. They have a small pond with lily pads and houses that look like tree stumps. I just let my imagination run away from me as I created my own little world of magic. I asked my daughter what she thought once it was all set up, and being a teenager at this point, she didn't quite believe in the magic anymore. She said that it looked like a five-year-old had been playing outside and forgot to bring their toys in. I had to chuckle because that's kind of how I felt. The world I had been creating in my head for years was finally in front of me. Each year, I add a new piece to my garden. Unfortunately, I usually have to remove a piece that was damaged by the elements as well. None of this deters me, though. I feel like I have a magical little kingdom in my own yard. While this garden may not have many flowers, although there are a few mushrooms and succulents, the amount of joy it brings me is immeasurable. And after all, shouldn't a garden bring joy first and foremost? This was The Last Word on My Fairy Garden with Christy Page at greenprints.com.
Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you. You can find Washington Gardener online at washingtongardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.